All right. Joining us from Hangzhou in China after all your various travels, John, and I guess you're feeling a little better after catching something. You're good to go now. You're good to pod.
I'm good to pod.
Yeah. All right. That's good. Good to catch up. So we were just talking before I hit record that we went over to Colombia. I guess you could call it my alma mater, but I don't know if people refer to their law school that way, but we went to go check out the scene, and a lot of cops. A lot of cops out there.
I spent not time a lot of there too at the Jays. I mean, I spent time too as a sort of senior fellow there
at Columbia.
So
what years?
So it feels like that. It's about 2017, 2018 that.
Oh, okay. Much more recent than me.
Yeah, very recent. So, you know, very familiar place. Was there every day, and then to see those scenes. And I actually did visit it before I left, you know, late October before I came here.
Mm-hmm.
But you were
pretty
saying
peaceful about, most of the time.
Yeah, pretty peaceful. Yeah.
I mean, it's still peaceful. I wouldn't say that it was a crazy scene or anything like that, but the amount of security and, you know, the campus is locked down. You can't actually get on the campus if you're not, you know, an active student or a faculty member right
now.
You need
to
show
difference.
ID.
That's something that
I've never seen it closed before. That one, all the gates, including on 116 on both ends, are completely locked down. So
especially as it's an easement, right? As you say,
There's a public easement going through 116, so they generally are supposed to keep it open. They have the right to close it, I think, for people, you know. It's not typical for those gates to be locked.
Yep.
It is a public space. Yeah.
Yep. Hello, but you're saying hi, Jess.
Hey,
hello,
Jess.
Hello, sorry, my apologies. I'm a little late.
No worries. We just got started, like literally just a minute ago, and we're talking about Colombia. You know, I went to go.
It's not, you know, physically the demonstrations and so on are not such a huge sort of presence on the campus, but this is going to attract people the way the media is focusing on it, right?
And
there's of course all the congressional grandstanding around it, which is turning it into
Biden too. I mean, Biden released a statement saying that it was borderline terroristic what was going on.
Yeah,
and you've got Colombia, the administration, and I think this is the thing now is, like, you know, the administration and the faculty are like very different things now. You know, like they're like separate factions within the university, and the administration is sort of in control here, and they're expelling students or suspending students and then having them arrested for trespassing. So they're doing these sort of like legal shenanigans to try and get their, you know, try to, you know, put an end to these very job-threatening protests, let's put it that way. And now you've got professors signing letters condemning the administration, you know, and you see, you know, half the, you know, a lot of media is still presenting kind of like anti-protest, pro-Israel sort of view of this. But, you know, you have a lot of mainstream reporters now going, I don't really see what the problem, like what's going, like why are they doing this, you know? So I think the overall thing that I'm noticing, and this happened at Google too, where those employees had sort of quote stormed the CEO's office and then got themselves arrested and fired, that there is chaos going. I figured that this would happen because it involves Israel. I figured that there would be a big schism in a lot of the elite institutions, and that's what we're seeing. We're seeing infighting and chaos going on inside Ivy League universities and the top tier tech companies, and it is not calming down. It is getting worse by the day.
Yes. And there are other issues, and I think at Columbia, that emerging through this protest. And one of these is the, I think, the alienation of the faculty from the administration. So, I mean, if you have any experience with the place, it's a highly bureaucratic, it's like this mega corp. And decentralized, and it feels very impersonal, at least at the administrative level. And I think there's some of that frustration. That extraordinary letter that the faculty released, very tough letter, the AAUP, American Association of University Professors. I mean, they released this letter and they talked about the two issues that this president, Shafiq, had ignored or neglected. One of these was, of course, freedom of speech, but the other was governance and just this lack of consultation, the norm-breaking, as someone put it, around this. I think other issues are emerging through this. So there are other tensions. Whenever protest breaks out, I mean, people come on, but they have other reasons. There's other frustrations. I'm not saying the Palestine thing isn't the main thing.
No, I think you're onto something. I suspect that a lot of the intensity of the infighting in the U.S. and especially among the elites.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of existing tensions.
Yes.
Are being projected onto this fight.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
It may not even, in many circumstances, it may not even really be at bottom about Israel and Palestine.
Right.
Like,
right.
It could. It's,
yeah.
it's other like tensions
yeah.
that
yeah.
haven't had a reason or like a, you know a nucleating event.
And exactly.
To
and
set
opening,
it off.
A nucleating event. Yeah. And in fact, in order to avoid the very fraught kind of politics around the language of around this sort of charge of anti-Semitism, a lot of the fight is over governance, consultation with the executive committee, right, of the Senate, that kind of thing. It's, you know, you could find entire letters and sort of protest that don't actually mention, and this is, of course, completely in order, but that don't mention the actual cause of the actual substance of the protest.
That's the dimension I found most fascinating.
It is fascinating. It's about university governance. It's about the kind of university we want. And I sympathize with that, you know, at Columbia.
It's about
the kind
ownership.
Of place.
It's mm-hmm. about a feeling of alienation from the institution that you were by, you know, in the case of the employees, you are serving and that you, you know, will face the responsibility for in the case of students, you know, it's an institution charged with, you know, the sets the tone for your adult life, basically. There's a strong tradition of campus protest. So it's almost, you know, irrespective of the thing being protested, I'm just de facto in support of students being allowed to speak out on these things. But I'll slip in to say we're right on track. This is a classic Peter Turchin intra-elite conflict we're talking about here.
Yeah.
That is a dynamic that seems to be in play here. Yeah,
mm-hmm. right? Very much. Yeah. So. I mean, I it's a worthy political cause, but I just don't see that this can get that personal unless, as you say, John, it's about, you know, that's what I found fascinating. All this public outpouring of an opinion one way or the other that don't even mention this.
Yes. Yes,
it's very much about, you know, faculty and students kind of, you know, insurrecting, if you will, against the corporatized bureaucratic layer.
Yes,
it's about saying this is an institution that, you know, we've invested our lives into. You know, in the case of students, paying a lot of money,
very high fees,
very high prices to be a part of, and saying like we have a stake in what this institution stands for and what you know, in the case of employees, what our labor goes towards. In a very real sense, this is a question of ownership at stake here,
which is a supremely principled but naive argument.
It is
about the nature of the university.
Naive, but
the kind of institution,
but it's very,
it is.
It's maybe it's naive. Because of the sheer power differential, but you know, I think it's pretty stark, and I don't think it's very black. I don't think it's very gray area as far as ideological conflict at stake here.
I mean, I think what's going on in to a large degree is that the form of the university and the form of the corporation have been disguised. The reality and the way these things work.
Yeah.
Has been disguised, and we don't understand that, you know, the average person, you know, we still think of Columbia as an academy or Harvard as an academy. These are These are hedge funds with a school attached.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
I mean, so Columbia's endowment
is very, very important. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Columbia is a 13, I'm looking at Google right now, $13.64 billion hedge fund slash largest property owner in Manhattan.
Yep.
Right? I mean, they're basically taking over in terms of land ownership. They're taking over in Upper Manhattan.
And with that sum, they're always aware that they're the smallest among the, you know, the big Ivies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Harvard's always there's always this complex about our have, oh, only 13.6, you know, Harvard is.
Yeah, well, yeah, Harvard's looking at them like, that's cute. Million. That's very cute.
Because of, yeah, because of that, we have to be ultra aggressive. So there is the university as this real estate enterprise, which has been written about, actually. And
these are,
and
these are supremely tax-advantaged capital mountains of capital.
Yep.
But
at the heart of it, the thing that all this is parasitic on is something not captured by this. It's that it's supposed to be an autonomous community, literally a self-ruling community. That's the medieval origin of it, and that's what gives it life in the Western context. A university is an association of scholars and students that come together on their own, and they are self-governing. So, you know, that space, there is a kind of medieval sense of autonomy. This is our space, just like, for example, you know, you have, you know, churches, the police don't just barge in. It's the same thing with universities. And something, you know, it was symbolically, it's already violated, of course, in letter and in spirit. But the barge, these cops barging in like that, riot police coming in, was a pretty graphic demonstration of where things are. I mean, it's just the mask come off of the system. So it's kind of too much for a lot of people, and people, I feel, are galvanizing around it, don't you think?
I think it's so. That was very shocking imagery. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure people, I'm sure there are still many people who actually lived through the, you know, the Kent State disaster.
Yes.
Right here on U.S. soil. So that's another, you know, vivid reminder of, and that was a widely condemned. That's still considered. So I don't know how you
big Columbia
Kent State to be a tragedy, but then the same people will come out and say, no, these kids totally had it coming.
And the famous Columbia one 50 years ago. So they're proud of it. You know, on campus, they advertise this to students coming in, right? This is the great place where we had these, you know, powerful demonstrations in the 70s, you know, and the cops came in and we beat them off, right? And then they advertise the fact that they brag about their association with Edward Said.
Right.
As someone said, and they have Franz Fanon on the core curriculum. Mm-hmm. But then now when it comes to this, this is how the administration behaves. So you do see, I agree with you, a war between the elites, but two very different types of elite, this administrative one that has basically taken over the modern American university, and these scholars who try to be, or who, if they don't do something about it, are going to end up just as this kind of state apparatchiks, right? Just you know, bureaucrats.
This brings to mind my favorite quote. I don't know if it's a real one or not, but it's the Mao quote about, you know, all under heaven is chaos. The situation is just fine, or whatever that quote is. Because I look at this, I look at these conflicts, and here's the thing: these are good conflicts. These conflicts are not meaningless. These are, people are taking a stand. Real issues. And here's the thing, like, I don't want to just, I mean, I'll say this, that I was a little bit shocked at the rhetoric that was going on at Columbia by the protesters. Now, I'm not saying that I'm against what they were saying, and I'm not saying that they shouldn't be allowed to say what they say. But to call for, you know, like the burning down of Tel Aviv, I understand why they're saying that. I understand that is no less inflammatory than things that have been officially said about what we should do to Gaza. I get it. I'm just saying that the tensions are high and that this isn't a cute little student demonstration or whatever. This is hardcore shit. I don't think anyone should feel like they were in any sort of like immediate physical danger or anything like that. But I would say that it does take some getting used to see the level of where this rhetoric is. So what's going on there is pretty fucking serious in terms of our commitment to this thing called free speech. And I don't believe at all for, you know, this notion that I've seen that written in some liberal outlets like Vox or whatever that says, you know, just very blithely that these campus protesters are pushing the limits of free speech. They're not. This is the heart. This is not the boundaries of free speech. This is the very heart of free speech, which is
are you really saying that seriously?
Yes.
So it was a minority.
It was in Vox, and that was in. This was written in relation to the USC valedictorian speaker who was removed because she's pro-Palestinian, and USC just said, we're not having any speeches this year because none of you can handle this stuff. And Vox said that this was pushing the boundaries of free speech.
No, these are kids, and you can always take the most extreme things they say, but if you listen to their chants and so on, this is pretty standard stuff, except that we're criminalizing standard stuff, you know, from the river to the sea, for example, right, is being criminalized. Literally.
Well, protesting, burning your draft card, right? In the middle of the Vietnam War. Yeah. That's literally, I mean, what kind of charge was that's bound to have been felonious, right?
But let's not hide behind from the river to the sea as being, you know, that's not what they're saying. They're saying we need to destroy Israel. Right? Now, again, like if you know, Israel has clearly said that they don't believe in a two-state solution, and the U.S. has clearly, you know, vetoed the admission of Palestine into the United Nations. So this is an existential struggle now, right?
Yeah, it is.
We're not seeking compromise.
No.
So what my point is, there, you know, witnessing what was going on there, you know, you can't sugarcoat what's going on. You know, I mean, this is heated shit because they are having a real discussion.
They're having a real
about what is really happening, and what's really happening is not, you know, abstract philosophical debates. This is
precisely the kind of thing that is being banned, right? Real discussion, real disagreement.
There is no feel good movie you can make about this moment that can be wrapped in liberal platitudes. That's ultimately the heart of this. Like, there's no way, there's no good spin to take on this. You have to take a side. Isn't that a thing of liberalism that has annoyed you guys at various points? The inability to actually take a hard opinion that isn't completely watered down to nothingness. It just basically devolves into nothing more than a cliched platitude. And that's, you know, their purported ideological hard stand, basically a Disney movie plot point.
It's that Thomas Friedman article, how to be pro-Israeli, pro-Palestinian, and pro-Iran.
Yeah, you're like, I'm pro people. I'm not pro any side. I'm pro people here.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And this, it's a, you know what that is? I mean, if you look at what's really motivating,
besides infantile.
What it is,
supremely coddled and infantile.
Okay. Absolutely, it is. Absolutely, it is. And I think that the marker of that infantilism is self-centeredness. And the liberal view, I think, is to say, you know, what really matters is what people think of me. How do I appear to the world as pro everything? I don't want to be. I want to be basically good, like pro everything. That's good. You know, like I don't want to be anti anything. I transcend all of these conflicts because I'm a good person in my heart.
How is the liberal position now? Sorry, how is the liberal position, which is supposedly sort of banal, now the liberal position in this conflict is on the side of the is on the Zionist side, right? And that's the one that's criminalizing speech and saying it's. Are both sides kind of, you know, are we beyond it now? But the liberal. At least the frame for it, if you look at, for example, Biden's statement, it's about, you know, safety, protecting, you know, Jewish students. You know, it's the kind of harm principle or the that's being invoked here.
I'm saying that a liberal position, or is that the position of someone who's tending to?
It's a development of liberal language, right? Of and that kind of this being about me. if you take that assistant professor, we shall not name, who's the mega victim and also the mega persecutor at Columbia of students and faculty, right, who are allegedly all Hamas. That guy, for example, it's all about his feelings when yeah. you know.
Right.
So there is something
that was it not about their feelings? No, let me push back. I mean, is it not yeah. about the feelings of those who see the images coming out of Gaza and what it does to them?
Well, precisely.
And how it makes them feel?
Precisely, they don't care about that. It's some people's feelings and some people's, because it's infantile. You know, it's my feelings versus your feelings. But then all of a sudden, and this is the unsaid part about the whole kind of liberal enterprise, there's a demarcation. The feelings of some people, the rights of some people matter more than those of others. So, yeah, precisely, it should matter. And I do see some of the protesters and the students talking about, you know, you're traumatizing colored people. I don't know whether that's the right argument to make because, frankly, they don't give a shit about you guys, okay? And that's structural. You're subhuman in this scheme, but the humans, the proper people, need to be protected. So you have a giant protection enterprise around, this huge effort around protecting certain students, right? The pro-Zionist students from harm, from distress. And all of a sudden, it's not about Israel, it's not about Gaza anymore. It's about the feelings of Jewish students here. This is very like what people call the kind of woke discourse. I don't know, my thoughts are not well formulated here, but it's the same sort of thing, the same sort of narcissistic. It's about my feelings. And therefore, you are no longer in the realm of argument about reasons and things like that.
Yeah, it's an in-group bias.
In-group.
A protective in-group protectionism, so to speak.
It's about victimhood. Yeah, it's about mm-hmm. rights, you know, from victimhood.
Who is the sympathetic victim in
who is the sympathetic victim, exactly?
Well, have we considered that it's less class? Ideological and simply institutional? So as far as the liberal and conservative split, it's not really, I don't feel like it's a really organic outgrowth of genuine feeling, but more like if you listen to NPR and read the New York Times and the Atlantic, you will espouse this set of values. If you subscribe to, I don't know, Fox News, whatever is going on that side of the aisle, you will fall in with that side. So it's less about having a principled stance and just saying, I have picked up my politics from the top page of the front page of the New York Times. They are pro-Israel. I am pro-Israel.
Hold on. I think the position that the two of you are taking on this vis-a-vis liberalism is, I think this is a characterization that I think can't hold anymore, which is that the liberals, there is no consistent liberal view on this. I think there's plenty of liberals who are taking side with the protesters, the pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel protesters. I think there are plenty of them.
Yeah,
and right. I also think that there's plenty of faculty and there's plenty of professors who are on the side of those kids. Mm-hmm. Right?
There are.
And what I'm suggesting, and if you look closer at some of the stories that are coming out, like, for example, CNN, liberal outlet, you know, the maybe sort of the paragon of liberal media right now, in terms of like mass media. They had an internal rebellion by some of their reporting staff, including Christiane Amanpour, to say, we're no longer doing knee-jerk pro-Israel stuff. We have to start reporting critically of Israel.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting. Right. Really? I didn't know about that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, yeah. CNN has taken a very different tack.
No, there was
that was spearheaded by people like Christiane Amanpour.
Yeah, yeah. There was a whole segment with Anderson Cooper. A guy who actually turns up at the gym wearing IDF t-shirts, right, by some accounts. But that whole section was about, you know, when the Israelis bombed, when the IDF drone bombed a bunch of kids playing at a foosball table, right, and killed eight of them. They humanized. They deliberately, and they said they were doing it. It was very self-conscious. We decided we would show the face with the agreement of the parents of this particular girl. And they named her. I mean, they gave her name, showed her face, whereas others were blurred out. And they followed her. I mean, they carried this poor child's body, you know, to the hospital. So, you know, of course, they still talked in this sort of, you know, bromide-y way about you know, these are the victims of war. You know, not that they were actually, you know, it's as if these children are just the helpless victims of a war, of this thing, of this vague thing out there. So that's still CNN. But they're deliberately focusing on, you know, humanizing some of the kids now.
Yes.
I felt that there was some kind of rebellion
going on.
Something is going on.
Look at the State Department. There's been more and more leaks about what's going on at the State Department. It is a bureaucracy which is at the heart of this, right?
Right.
Which is having an internal civil war among the staff.
Yeah.
And the initial reports about a small group of staff like quitting or whatever is minimizing the intensity of the fighting going on inside. And all this to say is that we have tried to both sides, the liberals have tried to both sides this this conflict, which is going on 70 plus years now, right? For as long as they can. Now that it's out in the open, I think that the problem is that there's no consistent liberal view. Now, it's the official policy, you know, one side or the other is going to have is going to win the policy fight, right? So Columbia, to the extent that it's you know, a singular institution with one president who sets policy, right? Columbia is going to come out and give the appearance of saying this is where Columbia University stands, but the reality is, I guarantee you, there's loads and loads of infighting even among the administrators and with their faculty and students and all that. So I'm saying that the liberal institutions are trying to give the appearance that they are all aligned and internally have decided this is the way to go. I think they're being torn apart from the inside. And good. That liberalism has no way to have a consistent view of this, because no matter what side you pick, you're violating some aspect of the liberal coalition. You know, and it's not all about morality, and it's not about right and wrong. It's also about factionalism, and you know, who is the liberal coalition? You know, so that's how I see things. And in a way, I'm like, good. This to me is just part of the long arc of the fall of the liberal coalition that I think really started in earnest the moment Hillary lost to Trump. And that, you know, the loss of that coalition really marked an end of an era of the United States that stretches back to, God, I don't know.
I thought Trump consolidated when you say the liberals here, you mean sort of the Democrat alliance.
I thought he consolidated
and radicalized these liberals in this sense.
I think this, if you notice that Me Too movement started almost immediately after Hillary lost, and that was primarily, if you really look at the details of it, it was primarily an attack started by the East Coast media establishment against Hollywood, right. And that was a brewing war that had been in the works for years, decades, maybe. That the sort of Clinton faction of the Democrats was able to sort of massage into a functioning coalition. But the second she lost, it was open warfare. And that, you know, that was a minor thing compared to what's going on now. But it's been this snowballing effect of the disintegration of a consistent liberal order. And this Israel situation, I think you couldn't dream up of a more fracturous thing to happen to the liberal coalition.
I mean, that's fantastic. I'm not very plugged into cable news, or much less what's going on at the State Department. What you're describing is true. I'm excited. This is a great development because we've been needing this for quite a while.
That's what I'm saying.
In a different formulation, this is kind of the first signs of the disintegration of third way liberalism.
Yeah. It is. I think this is the end of the Clinton era. You know, this is
so. You know, the tide of liberalism that Bill Clinton won ushered in, where basically foreign policy, domestic policy, and feel good liberalism were basically splintered off into separate tracks, and it just went. You could go depraved on any of the axes, so long as you dialed in the feel good
feelings.
The good feeling message. That's basically all.
He this was is clarifying the conversation. I mean, this
that was a specific. That was a very. That was part of his pitch to get corporate America on board with him. I will let you send all the jobs you want overseas. I will let you gut the country. They will not have any other choice.
I will bomb Belgrade.
Yeah.
Yep.
This is the era of liberalism we've lived under. My entire adult life to this point. Then,
yeah, I think it's the coming. It's the end of this order.
Right? Hallelujah! Yeah,
I think Joe Biden is the end point of this, and there's no
one capstone.
There's really no viable successor here.
Is Hillary saying, get over yourselves, right?
Yeah, get over yourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Her first campaign slogan that they had to wrestle her to the ground to change. It's her turn.
Right. Right.
These are the fights that their coalition and their sort of chokehold on politics and power was able to suppress. But the thing with all conflicts is, I think the longer you suppress them, the more intense they get until you can't hold back any longer. And we are already in a state of internal infighting among. Yeah. And here's the thing. You never know who's on what side. Have you noticed that it's really hard to predict who is on what side of this? I'm talking about the Israel issue. It's not clear like who would be on what side. When it comes to famous people or people you know.
Well, politicians, which side they're on. I mean, if anybody's in Congress.
Congress
yeah,
is...
well, any sort of political, it's pretty much 99%.
Well, even with Israel, do you remember, the only way they got the Ukraine funding bill passed over the weekend or on Friday was to separate out Israel. That was the only way that they could get the Democrats to reach any agreement with Republicans to get it passed. So the Ukraine thing, the Democrats are all like, hey, that, because the Ukraine intervention, I think, is just like classic liberal, neoliberal shit, right? Like just classic, because we don't really have any, there's no real dilemma here with Ukraine, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of what the liberals think. But when it comes to Israel, that's a whole other problem, right? And so they had to strip it out. They had to make it two separate bills to get it passed. So I think they're already like Israel, I think to me is if there's anything that could absolutely rip the liberal coalition apart, it's Israel.
Ukraine certainly didn't do it. Maybe Israel
Ukraine didn't would. Do it. Me, but like Me Too, I think was just a preview of what was going to come in terms of this chaotic infighting where you're not really sure what the sides are. Like, you don't know who's up next. You don't know what's going on. And those are the most, I think, destabilizing types of conflicts where you're not even sure who's on what side. I don't know what you guys think, but I just find it very hard to predict who actually thinks what.
Yeah.
There's
a brewing university. As far as the campuses and are concerned, right, the universities, I feel as if that there's been a lot of this suppression of protest, right? Beginning with, the Penn, Harvard, and MIT being called up by Congress, and then just this environment of fear of speaking out in any sort of pro-Palestinian stance or anti-genocide stance. But these students at Columbia, it feels as if they kind of broke the dam. They went ahead, and you know, they risked themselves, and then suddenly the faculty are flocking after. So it feels as if something has broken. And there were a lot of people who actually agreed with them but didn't dare speak up. And now they can get behind them, not necessarily on their particular issue out there in Gaza, but on other issues, you know.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's a safer environment for them now than it was.
It's much safer to speak
earlier up. In the year or late last year, because I think that they've now suddenly realized, like, guys, you have some pretty powerful support too. Like, this is a bona fide civil war going on inside the liberal coalition. You are not without your supporters, including in the government, including in media,
and then including among the, you know, powerful professors, right? Like Adam Tooze,
powerful professors
at Columbia. Yeah. He's joined the Gaza encampment.
Yeah,
right.
Wait, who was that?
Adam Tooze?
Oh, okay.
What is he a scholar of?
Economic history. And he's German born. And you know, if you look at his posts on Twitter, on X, he's been critical, but in a pretty guarded way, as I think all academics.
Cornel West showed up and Cornel West showed up.
Yeah, he showed up and spoke up, but he's more identified with this sort of thing. But Adam Tooze is a very kind of he's not seen as a figure of the left.
So a little bit harder to predict that
a bit harder to predict, but also somebody with real insight into what's going on in Germany, and also distressed by, you know, upset about what happened to, you know, freedom of speech in Germany, about a, you know, insanely repressive kind of atmosphere around this now. So
I think
very
all this
strange
said, I think,
suppression.
I think
it's not just Colombia, right? It's not just the U.S.
No,
in Germany,
it's not,
they just break into conferences on Palestine and disrupt them and break people up. Again, you have this kind of riot police techniques. Just incredible what's going on. Germany, France as well. So what's happening here? It's across both the U.S. and sort of Western Europe, you'd think.
This is just all very exciting. I was just going to say, you know, if I had to guess what kind of university the tide would sort of break at, I guess Columbia makes a lot more sense to me than a Harvard or an MIT.
Why is that?
I think it was never going to happen at MIT. The amount of defense funding that goes into that school. I was noticing it, you know, when I was there, and it's only accelerated since then. It's a very repressive atmosphere for the pursuit of the sciences and engineering.
Yeah, I think Columbia's sort of like being embedded into Manhattan and New York City is why.
Yes,
I think
you're
right.
You have some strong Palestinian scholars,
depoliticized.
Right, Columbia has always been a flashpoint for this type of thing. You know, and a strong representation of Jewish students, and you know, this oligarch money as well.
Yeah, and Manhattan has been the site of a lot of protests, like the Jewish Voices for Peace people who took over. Very early on, I might add, they basically just took over Grand Central Station.
So do you think that this is? I have this sense that there's a kind of breaking of the dam here.
Yes.
And there'll be solidarity from other campuses. And then that kind of intra-elite conflict starts to break out.
I mean, people are just like, you know what? Fuck it. I've had enough. I'm throwing in my, I'm going in. That's what, you know. I mean, think like even my wife was like, hey, let's go check out Columbia. I'm very keen. You know, like she's like, let's go see what the fuck is going on. I want to see this. People are not as shy, you know. I think when it first started, you know, John, I was telling you, like, the feeling of being at, you know, a large law firm in Manhattan, and with the law firm signing these pledges to revoke offers to anyone who have their name on any of those letters. Like if you were just part of the South Asian Law Students Association, you know, you're done, you're toast, right?
Yeah.
So just seeing that those initial, you know, sort of like acts by the law firms and these huge news reports and stories all the time and not a mention of it ever at work.
Yeah.
Even though at work, you know, among lawyers, it's like we like to talk about current events. We talked about Ukraine all the time. I mean, that we weren't shy about talking about that. But you don't talk about Israel. And there was a real shyness and I think a obvious reason why you don't talk about it. But, you know, I think probably still at the elite workplaces, you don't want to talk about it. I don't talk about it. Certainly do not talk about it. But it's getting harder and harder to pretend like that's not happening.
Yeah.
And this is the real my workplace, for example,
yeah. Yeah.
My workplace, for example, which I won't mention what it is, but our building had, it's got a police presence all around the perimeter now, specifically because of the danger of protests.
Wow.
It used to be private security. Now we've got NYPD officers there.
Wow.
And I, you know, you got to flash your badge to even get on the sidewalk.
This one is going to be particularly incendiary and heated because of the insanely, you know, the hysterically and violently sometimes policed speech around Israel. You know, the stakes are super, are inflated beyond beyond anything, right? They're inflated to the nth degree. If you're against this, you're for genociding, as they said at Congress, you're for genociding the Jews all over again if you oppose what Israel is doing in Gaza. So this kind of really inflated policing of speech, and it's very repressive. So people have been under a very, very repressive speech code around this. And I think they sense it breaking. It's just not sustainable anymore. And it's how polarizing can it get? For some people, this is about genocide. It's not about whether I support one state, two states, whatever. You know, there's no genocide. There's a very simple position. I could imagine some liberal, some principled liberal taking that position, right? So I think that's happening and that's breaking.
One thing I'm saying that
I'm agreeing with you, but you know, there's a lot of petrol on this. There's a lot of gasoline on this. And it's because that issue, and you have the government behind it. You have the political class, Congress, so delusionally, fanatically pro-Israel.
Let me add a little gloss to this idea, though, because one thing I did notice is I've never, for all of the effort that the American propaganda machine has put in over what seems like a decade now, right, of throwing gas onto this China is going to, you know, is going to, this China thing, right?
Yeah, and a damp squib, yeah.
And it included rhetoric about genocide of Muslims.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, here's my point. I've never seen any protests about China in the United States. I've never seen it. Now, have I seen a couple, Falun Gong people with it? Yeah, I've seen that. Okay, fine. But I've never seen students or otherwise, let's call them just, normal Americans. Okay, not FLG types, but like just, you know, regular run-of-the-mill Americans or students or anything organize a protest against China. I've never seen it. I've never seen it. Despite, I would say, like a mountain's worth of effort to stoke that kind of reaction. It's never happened. It's never happened. And as far as I can tell, I've never seen it myself, never heard of it myself. And all we get is Drew Pavlo with a Where Is Peng Shuai t-shirts over at Wimbledon with everyone looking at him like he's crazy. Right?
Yeah.
What I find very interesting about this is that I'm starting to realize that propaganda at some level doesn't work. You can't get you can get people to believe stuff. You can get people to believe stuff, but you can't get people to really feel it. You can't get people to really feel it in their hearts the way that they're feeling the reality of what's going on. In so not only is that not the anti-China stuff not stoking, you know, genuine feeling and organic protest, but the other side of this is true as well. The positive propaganda that's being heaped in favor of Israel just also doesn't work. And I think that nothing could be more clear than this than all the protests that are going on outside the embassy of Israel in Washington, in Northwest DC, the Israeli embassy. You have Aaron Bushnell setting himself on fire. You've got protests daily. You've got just all this shit going on in front of the Israeli. Right next door, ironically, is the PRC embassy. Quiet.
I did not know
peaceful. That. Peaceful. Not a single demonstration going on. They're literally right next to each other. And nothing. Despite mountains of all of the propaganda effort meant to make Israel our friend and all of the propaganda effort to make China our enemy, you show up to these two buildings and guess which one has U.S. service, you know, Americans pouring their hearts out in protest. It's not China. They don't care. It's Israel.
Well, the propaganda I just realized mobilize
propaganda
people.
Doesn't really work.
It doesn't work in that sense, but where it works is actually on speech, on you know, the kind of on the Overton window, if you will. So they do it enough to sort of taint China so that there's this vague sense that we shouldn't go there or that it's you know, sure. We shouldn't be too positive about it.
Yep.
But who does that work on? It works on the chattering classes. You know, it works on themselves.
The chattering classes.
It works
but
on
what
you,
my point is, when,
own,
you want,
on this,
when we're talking
small
about
group of people.
But when we're talking about stuff like war,
yeah,
and you, where you need serious. To win the hearts and minds of your own people to get behind something as risky and dangerous as that, like, this is why I really am not fearful of war with China. You can't propagandize people into that. It as far as I can see with my own eyes, it doesn't work, right? It doesn't work. You can get people to believe it, but that doesn't mean they feel it. So I'm not saying that people have a good view of China. I'm not saying they're not buying the lies. I'm saying they don't care.
They don't
I'm
care.
Saying they don't care.
I think it's seeding the ground for a top-down, to justify a top-down action, but I think you're correct. I mean, but
people don't care about Ukraine either.
People
and
don't.
We're still at war with, in the proxy war with Russia. They don't care that people
have
don't
you seen
care.
Any protests against Russia?
Yeah, exactly.
Not really.
I haven't. But, I've
and
never
still,
seen
doing
anything
this,
like the protests against Israel when it comes to Russia. I've never seen it.
Yeah, this is the thing. You can get to the proxy war level. You can even put 60 billion, you know, send 60 billion over.
Yeah,
but
correct.
You can't draft people on the basis of this.
That's program. Where that's becomes really difficult. But I mean, that's the challenge that Woodrow Wilson and then Roosevelt after him had. The U.S. public opinion was not for going to war either of those times. Mm. See, so, I mean, I totally believe in this. And Tina, the thing that you're saying is why I actually think 1984 is not a great work as far as the psychology of the masses goes.
Right, yes. No, I agree.
So why it's invoked so often
people.
Is not. It isn't. It's not. Really not. And this, I think it flatters a certain heroic perception of the self that, oh, no, I'm just the one that the propaganda won't work on. I would know that it's different. I think that's the thing that's kind of flattering. But as a picture of mass psychology, I find it pretty thin. However,
brain,
it is a fact.
The brain does not lead the heart. You can brainwash people. You can't heartwash people.
Sure.
You can't really get them to buy in at a deep emotional level. You can only make them believe certain things. But it doesn't mean that they care. that's the key.
Yeah, you know, until their personal, until like something directly, you know, personal.
Until they see it.
Until they see it. So I'll believe it to a point. However, we went to two world wars that had massive casualties against public opinion. So I don't know where that point is, and I don't know how to reconcile the two.
Attacked.
I just know that those two things.
No,
well, did we?
Pearl on the
Harbor,
historical record, we encouraged that attack.
Yeah, of course we did. Okay, fine. But it happened, and we had the pictures.
And waited for that attack, right?
Right, but we had the pictures.
We knew what would happen if we cut off Japan's access to fuel.
But you're talking about high level shit. I'm talking about your average person who's going to get drafted to go serve. They saw the pictures.
I mean, both times, public opinion was still massively against direct intervention.
Yeah, they had to get the people to feel it.
And the way they got the people to feel it is some sort of attack event.
Exactly.
Okay, so I'm saying like
fabricated or encouraged or engineered, whatever the case is, right? So you have.
So I think you're right, Teen. I fully believe you, but it's not for me though. It's still not reason. I don't want to become complacent about it. Is all I'm saying.
It's not about that. I'm just saying that the lesson I've learned from all this is that it's not that easy to just say we control the media, therefore we control everything. Yeah, because I feel like the degree to which the government and the corporations are able to control media, like that power is not absolute. And I think that those institutions are actually in a panic as to the degree to which they've lost control over that narrative, and they don't see any real way of getting it back. And the harder they try, the more they're losing the public. You know, I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, I am not seeing the consolidation of centralized power. I'm seeing centralized power in panic, and I'm seeing that the traditional tools of that power are failing. I see that the liberal order is weak and falling apart, and it's been on decline since at least 2015. Yeah. Right. So we're talking on going on a decade long decline now. I think Joe Biden represents the terminal endpoint of this. Yeah. And I think something new is.
That's great. I like that. Because if America is good at anything, it's retard mode. So I know that's not polite language, but America's very, we have our flaws, but we are very, very good at just fuck it. We roll.
At the same time, yeah, and at the same time, I've never seen the American public this bought into having public debates about law, about morality, about policy, even about history. I'm not saying that they get it right all the time, but I'm saying, like, you know, we are not nearly as shallow as we were at the start of this thing in the 90s.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, we are a much more introspective and passionate culture now than we were, let's say, 30 years ago.
America. Well, critical, critical. It's a good one.
Yeah,
and that's, you know, and as much as they try to spin it as conspiracy mindedness, it's just called to me, it's just defection from the given order. Right, I see it all over the place. It's down to people questioning what's in their food, right? Don't you guys see this all the time? People wondering, you know, is this actually food? What's in our medication? What's in the water? Our air is poisoned. Everything is a lie. Nothing is actually real. Just every time someone questions that, this is one further step away. I didn't really see that 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And I don't even have to look outside. I feel this way now. I pay more attention to, like, my food. I read, like, the water quality charts and then somehow think that they're all a lie anyway. Because they probably are. So it's growing distrust. It's people losing faith in institutions. And again, but I mean, that doesn't come without a dark side. I think it's been a very, very rich terrain for scam artists, grifters. We have a lot of exploitation going on in that margin. So it's a chaotic time.
So yes,
I don't know.
I think we agreed on that. And I agree. It's chaotic. And then you see another thing that reinforces your point, Teen, is the increasingly desperate moves. You see a lot of very desperate kind of rear guard actions, which are frankly self-destructive, but they do it anyway.
They do it anyway because they have no other choice.
Yeah, it's incoherent. Do it anyway.
Like calling the cops on your own students?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Did you not think a step ahead even to what? So they keep doing this sort of stuff, and some of it is performative. You probably know it's not going to do anything, but you just have to perform it, perform power, so to speak. But then where we go next depends on your theory or your sense of how people can mobilize and on the nature of this new form of power. So it's distributed, it's chaotic. Is it getting, it's incoherent, but where is that going to lead? And are people going to be able to come together? That's why the Columbia students are kind of a bright sign. I don't know where this will lead, but it's great to see these kids stand up and do this. And I think a lot of the faculty feel like that. And they're going to get behind them.
They're chaos agents. You know, I have to say,
yeah.
I am surprised at how much of my own faith and investment in that, in the basic competence and trustworthiness of the liberal order was. I've had to revisit that. Now, a perfect example of this is COVID. I was absolute throughout COVID. I was squarely on the side of the idea that we should have universal vaccination, that the lockdowns were good, and that the people who were questioning the efficacy of the vaccine, which doesn't work, it doesn't actually work. I'm triple vaxxed, and I've gotten COVID a number of times. Right, it doesn't actually work as a vaccine. I'm shocked at how I've been forced to question the loyalties and competence and even the intentions of our own government. You know, I never thought I would be that. I'm not, I have no, priors of thinking that, but, you know, when I started to see the details of what was going on in terms of the way that Pfizer and other big pharma companies operated, then I'm starting to see, wait, maybe there is a reason to be skeptical about Novo Nordisk and pushing Ozempic on people, right?
Absolutely.
I'm starting to see, like, wait, maybe I committed myself to, you know, to a certain kind of ruling regime that, for whatever reason, maybe because I led a pretty comfortable life and I was afforded a lot of success and things in my own life, that I didn't think to question these things. I wasn't given a reason to question these things. And now, even though my life is still pretty good, I'm seeing everything around me starting to fall apart, and then I'm starting to see the tide go out, and I'm starting to see what was underneath there. And I'm like, I am shocked how I'm so middle of the road when it comes to politics. I'm so blandly liberal. I mean, I raised money for Hillary. I voted for Biden. And now I just cannot, all of that has been called into question. Now, if that's happened to me, think about what's going on out there, because I feel like I'm so, far from, you know, the heart of this. You know, I don't serve on the faculty of some, you know, what, like some university that's, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. If I'm feeling this, then I feel like that is just due to probability theory.
Right. What would be happening two or three standard deviations away from you?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I feel the same. I think we're roughly in the same, same background, roughly. And we're all questioning these things.
Yeah.
And we're all more or less on balance the beneficiaries of the system. Like, if the system that's in place did not work for us, that means there's a lot of people who were completely crushed. And turns out the numbers show that. So I think it was very, very damning that throughout the COVID debacle, we never had a proper reckoning about what the character of the people that were opposed to the institutional policies that were, you know, mandated on all of us, that it was always shoved off to, oh, ignorance. You know, the quote, you know, to your own research became a joke punchline.
Yeah.
You guys know this, right? You guys have seen this, right? I can't be the only one. He's like, he's one of those do-your-own research types. You know what that means?
We're the people who are well integrated into it. And of a certain age, not kids, you know, who you might imagine would be more questioning, able to turn their worldview around. You don't, in normal times, you don't have people like this have their get radicalized, so to speak, have their worldview turned mm-hmm. around. And it's just happening on a massive scale. I completely identify with what you guys are saying.
Yeah, I mean, as I get older, it's, you know, that truism is that you get more conservative as you all know. Yeah. That the older I get, the more anarchist I become.
Yeah.
This is a completely unforeseen dimension of this trajectory. We've never had a proper reckoning by the colossal loss of trust in the system. Like, we live in a very, very complex society. No one person can know everything about every dimension that our lives and livelihoods depend on. We have to outsource some of that. Then that basically devolves into a trust relationship you build with institutions. You trust the FDA to make sure the drugs are what they say they are. FDA, you trust CDC. The EPA to keep our water clean. Mm-hmm. And that the CDC, all these institutions that have been that have built up their reputations on a long tradition of actually standing for the public good, which they are rapidly squandering. Now, we never had that recognition that the people who are opposed to this may not be doing this out of malice or, you know, even worse, under these are just racists, they're misogynists, they're homophobes, etc. All aggregated under the banner of, quote, Trump voter. I have never really seen an honest attempt on the standard liberal side to properly account for just why are there so many people like this? We voted Obama into office twice. He was unquestioningly the winner of that race twice. This same country suddenly has 60% people who don't believe that the vaccine is a vaccine.
Yep.
But that's a fact. It's not a vaccine. It doesn't work.
Okay. I'm saying like 60 to like some staggering number of people have had massive disagreements with COVID policy up to and including the vaccine, right? They don't trust the government has their best interest at heart, et cetera, so on and so forth. So I thought it was on the liberal side, it was actually kind of I don't even know what the proper word for this is, providing cover for a lot of bad, a lot of bad politicking to go on by saying, "Oh, this is—they're exactly just racists."
Look, you know what is such a perfect example of this that happened recently is, you got these Google employees that stormed the CEO's office, won't leave. They weren't violent. It was a sit-in. It was a fucking sit-in, right?
Yeah.
Arrested, fired, right? What was their complaint? Their complaint was that Google is deploying AI consultancy services to the Israeli government.
Yep.
And they don't want Google to work with the Israelis because, for obvious reasons. Well, the interesting thing was that Google was founded quite famously on the motto, the corporate, I don't even think it's a motto. I think it was part of their stated corporate mission, which you have to file with the state in which you incorporate. Don't be evil, right? Don't be evil. Yeah. They were famous for that.
Yep.
And now you have employees that were, and I don't think they're foolish. I think they knew what they were doing, but you had employees that were on the surface naive enough to say,
to hold them to it.
Don't be evil. Isn't that what it says in your corporate charter? And the response is basically laughter. Like, you really believe that? Now, I think that these employees were smart enough and probably disgruntled enough that they didn't really want their jobs anyway. They wanted to be fired. But it goes to show you, I think, that, you know, a lot of the messaging and stated belief systems, it's very paper thin. And we're never supposed to really believe that stuff. And for those of us that do, unfortunately, you pay the consequences if you do believe in it. But I think we're maybe at a stage where the kinds of things that the liberal establishment now are saying, come on, be real. We didn't really mean that. You don't really believe that. Now we're going beyond corporate charters. Mm-hmm. We're going to real core, you know, values here of like liberal society. We're talking about freedom of speech. Now, you can't call that drapery, right? That's your constitutional foundation. So I think that the fight here is going real deep. And it would be one thing to laugh at people to say, Google didn't really mean it when they say don't be evil. That was just a little stunt. But now we're having people say, look, the First Amendment doesn't actually mean what you think it means, you know, and you're like, wait, what? So, you know, I think that the naive here are putting up a good fight. You know, it's not so easy to just dismiss them as naive anymore.
This is the end of part one of a two-part podcast. The second part will be on the Patreon feed for supporters. If you'd like to support Plan A, just go to planamag.com. Sorry, you go to patreon.com/planamag.